Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we are going to be talking about something that's really been hot when it comes to a lot of programming recently, and that is a phenomenal piece of history relating to a magnificent ship, the Titanic. And my guest today, Michael Timon, has taken, I mispronounced his last name. He has just taken a whole different twist with this, which I think is absolutely fascinating. And that's what we're going to be talking about. We're going to go beyond death's door, transcending the Titanic. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. I appreciate being on.
Well, now you are in Hawaii, and what in the world ever made you decide? Because you've been involved with the paranormal, Michael, you've done so much research on this in so many different levels. What was it that appealed to you about the Titanic? I mean, this is a subject matter that's been talked about and talked about and talked about. Why was it so important to you?
Well, I do a lot of freelance writing, including for Atlantis Rising magazine, which has worldwide distribution. And about last October, the editor of the magazine asked me if I could write something about the Titanic for the March issue of the magazine, since he knew that the 100th anniversary was coming up. And I said, well, you know, what am I going to write differently than, you know, there's been a number of books and many articles on it. So after giving it some thought, I decided to dwell on the more mystical or transcendent aspects of the disaster. And once I put the article, which was only about 2,500 words, together, I said, well, boy, I've got enough here for a short book. And so I put it together real fast in about a month's time. I had a lot of reference material on it, and once I got into it, it didn't take me that long. And so that's how it came about.
Well, I'll tell you, I find it so interesting the way that you approached it, because you decided to come from a whole different positioning, and that was to get into the realm of the paranormal, people who had experiences before they even got on the ship. And this was just such a phenomenal vessel anyway. It was, I think, and you can correct me, I think at the time it was the biggest seagoing vessel in the world. Am I correct?
That's correct, yes.
Now, you talk about a passenger, William T. Stead. Now, he was a journalist. Why was he important?
Well, actually, his last name is spelled S-T-E-A-D, but I think it was pronounced Steed. I used to pronounce it Stead myself, but somewhere along the line I found out that he pronounced it Steed. So, he was a British journalist, and he was on his way to New York, to Carnegie Hall. He was a peace activist, and he was going to be giving a talk there on world peace. And he, as it turned out, he was one of the victims. But Steed was a spiritualist and wrote quite a bit about spiritualism, and he wrote about some. They weren't direct, you know, premonitions or conscious premonitions, but he wrote a couple of stories well before the Titanic went down that indicated that he had some subconscious premonitions. One of the stories was about a boat that sank that had too few lifeboats on it, and another one was about a boat that hit an iceberg in the northern Atlantic. And coincidentally, well, actually, there are two ships involved in that story. One was called the Majestic, and there was a psychic on the Majestic that somehow became aware of this other ship hitting the iceberg, and she told the captain about it so that the captain could change course and end up rescuing some of the passengers from this other ship. But just coincidentally, or whatever, the name of the captain was Edward J. Smith, who was the captain of the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that was a premonition or not, he didn't, he had no conscious awareness of it. But it may have been something in the subconscious that he tapped into. And then in a 1909 book, 3 years before the Titanic, he was giving a talk to a group on the subject of life after death, and he wrote, "In order to form a definite idea of the problem which we are about to attack, let us imagine the grave as if it were the Atlantic Ocean." Well, this is 3 years before, he was a victim, and, little could he have realized then that, the Atlantic Ocean would be his grave.
Mm-hmm. It's, the mind is so interesting, and historically, through various situations and conditions, whether it's been volcanic eruptions, and I'm trying to think of the one volcanic eruption where a reporter actually wrote about it. I don't know that it was Krakatoa, but it was a big one. And people wanted to know how he knew it. He wrote the story, and it was absolutely incredibly accurate, but it was put out before the volcanic eruption. So this is a similar patterning here. Now, one of the points of information that you bring out that I was totally unaware of is that there was another ship, the Dona Paz, which was a passenger ferry that collided with an oil tanker off of Mindoro Island south of Manila in the Philippines, that actually had more of a loss of life than the Titanic did.
Right. I just brought that into the introduction of the book to point out that, the Titanic is not the biggest maritime disaster on record. This Dona Paz, which was in 1986 or 87, had some 4,000 people that were killed on it. So that the Titanic had a little over 1,500, almost three times as many on the Dona Paz. And then a couple of other maritime disasters have had more than the Titanic. So what I was trying to get at, in the preface or the introduction of the book is to point out that there's more to it than the number of people who died in the disaster as to why, the Titanic story has remained so fascinating with so many people.
Mm-hmm. It really has. It's just for some reason grabbed the imagination for now, 100 years?
100 years yesterday, yes.
That's right. Now, you have some interesting stories here, and there are some people's names. You have Edith Evans, who was 36 years old. She was from New York City. There was a Colonel Gracie that is mentioned, and there was just an amazing situation with Colonel Gracie, because the men stood back. The women and children were loaded, but there was a lot of confusion that was going on. From some of the stories that you share, there were these people, they honestly didn't think anything was really wrong. The Titanic was never supposed to go down. But this man, Gracie's story, because he survived, his wife got a telepathic communication from him. Talk about Colonel Gracie and what happened with him.
Yeah, well, he was a New York, quote, gentleman. Back in those days, not everybody was a gentleman. A gentleman was somebody who didn't have to work a 9-to-5 job and was more or less independently wealthy. So he's described in the various books as a New York gentleman. I don't think he's, even though he's called a colonel, I think he only spent a few years in the Spanish-American War, and was not really a retired serviceman, but titles were very important back then. But anyway, Colonel Gracie was on his way back to New York, and he was one of the last off the ship. In fact, he may have been the very last off the ship. He remembers being sucked down he couldn't estimate the time. He just, to him it felt like it would, never end. But somehow he surfaced, and he believes probably the fact that he had a life jacket on saved him. That if he had not had the life jacket on, he probably would have been sucked down even further. But anyway, he surfaced, and then he started swimming around, and he came upon an overturned, collapsible lifeboat that a number of other people were climbing onto. Most of them crew members that were somehow getting onto this overturned lifeboat, and he climbed on, and he recalls that after the boat was fully filled, I think they had somewhere around 30 people on it when it was completely full, and other swimmers were coming up to it and trying to get on, and the other people on it were kicking them away and beating them off and so forth. And the story that really stood out to me when I first read it a number of years ago, he talked about a man who swam up to the boat. He couldn't see him, but he asked if he could board, and he was told to go away, get lost or whatever. And the man responded with the comment, "All right, boys, good luck and God bless you," and then swam away. And I always wondered who that man might have been, because he was never identified. His name came up a couple of times, too, in the testimony that in the investigations that followed the disaster, both in England and the United States. Several people referred to this man, this heroic man, who just, swam away and didn't fight it. And I thought it might have been William Steed, because he had that type of mentality. He was a very spiritual person. But in doing my research for the book, I came upon a man called Robert Bateman, who was a 51-year-old Baptist minister and a physician. He was both a physician and a Baptist minister. He had been to a revival meeting in England, along with his sister-in-law and a number of other people from his church or revival group. And his sister-in-law recalled that when he put her on the last lifeboat, his comments were, "Goodbye, God bless you." So in thinking about it, I don't know how many people would have commented goodbye and God bless you, but he said that both to his sister-in-law and to the men on the boat as he swam away. And the other thing is that Colonel Gracie said he didn't recognize the voice. Colonel Gracie was a first-class passenger, and Robert Bateman was a second-class passenger, so that might explain why he didn't recognize the voice, being a different class there. My speculation is that Dr. Robert Bateman was that heroic swimmer. His body was actually found 3 weeks later floating in the Atlantic by a cable-laying ship. And then what's also fascinating about Bateman's story is that after his death, his nephew, Tom, had received a letter from him. Dr. Bateman wrote the letter from Ireland when the ship stopped in Ireland and posted it there. And he said to Tom, he says, "Tom, if the ship goes to the bottom, I shall not be there. I shall be up yonder. Think of it." And then a week or two after that, his wife unlocked his roll-top desk and found a poem in it, right on the top of his pile of papers. And the poem read, "Do you shudder as you picture all the horrors of that hour? Ah, but Jesus was beside me to sustain me by his power. And he came himself to meet me in that way so hard to tread. And with Jesus' arm to cling to, could I have one doubt or dread of dread?" So whether that little poem was somehow a premonition that he wrote before he went on the trip, or whether it was written by some form of direct writing after his death, I mean, there's no way to say. But I just find that whole story about Dr. Bateman very fascinating. He's sort of my patron saint. I mean, when I die, I'd like to be able to go out that way.
Your story about Bateman is very interesting, because I know in many different cultures that I've had the opportunity to interact with, I have heard stories of people that say, an individual knew that they were going to be dying. And it's like they left all kinds of points of information. They were preparing to leave. And subconsciously, they knew it. Consciously, if you would have asked them, gee, are you going to die on this ship, they would have said, don't be ridiculous. But subconsciously, many times people are aware that there is going to be the ending of their life. And one of the stories that you have in the book, one of many, you talk about how there was a lot of very superstitious attitudes on the part of many of the people that were working on the Titanic. And you talk about one of the men who abandoned ship because it was John Coffey. He was 23 years old. He left the ship when it docked at Queenstown. And he said, I just had this feeling. I couldn't shake it. I didn't want to be on the ship. So he left his job. And there's others that did the same thing. And Elizabeth Dalzell, you said, made a notation about the superstitious attitude. And I'm quoting from your book. She said, I've crossed the ocean several times and traveled quite some, but in all of my experience, I have never met such a combination of superstitious people as were found among the passengers of the Titanic. And they were three sailors. They overheard that they could not continue the voyage on the Titanic. They were terrified that something was going to go wrong. And this is when, after the fact, even 100 years later, when you have this kind of an awareness, a kind of feeling, it's really tough when you think about it. It took a lot of courage and really a stalwart willingness to trust the intuitive part of themselves to say, I'm not going to go on that ship.
Definitely. I mean, there are a number of other stories, too, and I only touched upon some of them in my book. One of them was the mother of John Hume. He was a violinist on part of the ship's orchestra. She told him that something terrible is going to happen and, you know, please don't go, but he just laughed it off. And there was Jacques Futrelle, who was an American novelist. He somehow had a premonition before he left France. He wrote a letter to his brother-in-law with a power of attorney, telling him that, you know, he questioned whether he was going to make it, but, you know, he was going anyway. So he was also a victim. His wife survived, but there are countless, you know, at least a dozen other stories. But it's not only the Titanic. I mean, there are other, you know, there's a fairly recent book, I think published last year, and I don't have the name or of the author or the title of the book right offhand, but she wrote about all the premonitions connected with 9/11. There were, you know, at least seven or eight people she encountered that somehow subconsciously foresaw what was happening on 9/11. And, you know, I imagine if, you know, enough research were done, you could turn this up with a number of other disasters.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you talk about the great, the wonderful giant airship, the R-101, that Great Britain had built, and that crashed in France. We're digressing from the Titanic, and that was right in 1930, and there were all kinds of people that just said, this is something terrible is going to happen. And the question always comes up, with this being the case, and I know, having been in the work of mine for so many years, you wonder, could anything have been prevented? Could it have been stopped? That's typically the common questions in people's minds. Gee whiz, what if, could we, should we have done it? And I think when it came to the Titanic, the likelihood of anybody calling off this voyage is pretty remote. I mean, the captain wouldn't even pay attention to the factor that icebergs were in the area.
Correct, huh?
And they were just going, you know, a mile a minute to do this. But this is so interesting because you talk about various components of different environments that have had so many people saying, this is what we need to pay attention to. Now, in your book, you made the comment. The more spiritually evolved a person is, the greater their awareness is. And in your research with the Titanic, with many of these people who really felt that they might not come back from this voyage, yet did it anyway, how did you address that on the part of someone questioning you, let's say from an audience saying, well, what happens to free will? What is this something that they were destined to do? How would you respond to that?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, that's something that comes out in many books on spiritualism that have come through mediums about the more spiritually evolved the person is, the more his or her awareness is, and the greater, the higher level that person will end up, you know, after he or she dies. You know, it's not a black and white afterlife. There are many levels and sort of a moral specific gravity that the person ascends to after his or her death. And, you know, I think that a person with a higher moral specific gravity is better prepared to meet death, and apparently these premonitions come to that person in some way, although they may not recognize it as premonitions. It's in the subconscious and not a real awareness, but it's really hard to put your finger on.
For you, when you were doing this book, what was the most significant component that really affected you out of all of and the research that you have done? What was it that really made you go, wow?
Well, actually, it was the first chapter of the book. In the first chapter, I tried to describe how various people faced up to death. I think that's the real fascination with the whole Titanic story, is that these people, you know, had 40 minutes or so. The time from the ship hit the iceberg till the time it sunk was actually 2 hours and 40 minutes, but it really wasn't until the last 40 minutes or so that people began to panic and realize they weren't going to make it. In fact, many of the people who might be called heroic for staying on the ship were not as brave as, you know, one might have thought they would be, because they thought they were better off on the ship than in the lifeboats. They saw these lifeboats being lowered in jolts and jerks, and cut one of the lifeboats dropped the last 10 feet or so, and people just about fell off and fell out of it. And so it's hard to measure the fear factor with, you know, those who stayed on and those who actually got in the lifeboat. But when I, you know, as I read the various stories, there were really three, you know, approaches to death. There was one that I classified as dignified or stoic resignation, very calm or controlled approach to it, like William Steed. He was seen being very calm, helping people onto their lifeboats, and then at some point, he apparently retired to the smoking room and was reading a book, which was thought perhaps to be his Bible, but that there's nothing definite on that. But he faced death very calmly, in a dignified manner. And then there was the second classification I call controlled trembling. People were definitely, you know, in fear, but they controlled it. You could, you know, if you saw it, you could looked in their eyes, you knew they were scared, but at least they controlled it. And then the third approach to death was uncontrolled trembling, or, quote, panic. People who just, you know, couldn't control themselves and were, you know, screaming and running around trying to get on the ship. But there were a number of things reported that, you know, clearly indicated that people were looking out after themselves. After the ship went down, there was one of the lifeboats that only had 12 people in it. It could have carried as many as 48. And one of the people on that ship said that, you know, after the ship went down, they could hear all the screaming and crying and everything else going on by the people who were floating around, swimming in the ocean, and suggested that we should go back and, you know, pick up some of these people. But the two most prominent people on that ship, Lady Duff Gordon and her husband, Sir Cosmo Gordon, apparently talked him out of it, said that, you know, if they went back, the ship, the lifeboat would be swamped and they'd all end up in the ocean. So instead of trying to help pick up a few people, they went off in the other direction. So that's what fascinated me the most, is the three different approaches to death and dying, the brave ones and the cowards. I should add to that little story on Sir Cosmo. They had no recollection of that when they testified at the hearings after the a week or two hours, 3 weeks I think it was, after the ship went down. They said no, that never happened. But the crew members said that yes, that Sir Cosmo paid them £5 each after the, you know, he promised to pay him £5 each, which he did. After they were on the Carpathia, the ship that rescued them, and so, you know, it looks like he did pay them off, so it's not to go back and, you know, help people into the lifeboat.
You have some fascinating information after this tragedy. How William Steed, he actually communicated through a medium and gave a lot of instructions for his daughter as to how to dispose of private papers, etc. And that isn't something that is experienced all that commonly today, but at that time in England, there were some very, very talented mediums, and his daughter and other people were very much aware of what was being communicated, and it was all extremely accurate, and he chose to bring this information out. That is along with some of the most fascinating information that you have in your book. Now, all of this has been documented, and in your book, you have a statement where you say a controlling force is thought. And there are so many positive things about those that passed over, so many fascinating stories that you have in here. What is your website, Michael?
Boy, I get confused when I try to think of what. Actually, if you just put my name, Michael Tim, T-Y-M-N, into a Google search, it'll bring up my website. Again, it's T-Y-M-N, and I think the first thing it shows is it's White Crow Books is my publisher, and my website is at their website. I think it's,
WhiteCrowBooks.com.
White Crow Books, yeah. They're my publisher of my last three books, and if you just put my name in, it'll bring up, or if anybody's interested in the Titanic book, just put my name into into an Amazon search, and they can find it there. They get the name is T-Y-M-N. It rhymes with him, H-Y-M-N.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, I know you've got the other books, and you talk about how the ship of 80, all the way as far back as 160 years ago, there were many ways it demonstrated, just as today. You say there is so much that is available if people want to research it, and it is so important to have an open mind about this. And you have a number of points of information from William Steed in the back of the book about things that he said about being on the other side, passing along the information to other people. This really is a fascinating read. And, Michael, I think that you took on quite a project here, and it gives us a whole different view of a bit of history that is just as fascinating today to people as it was 100 years ago.
Well, I hope so. Actually, the book is probably more about William Steed than it is about the Titanic. It's about, I'd say, half and half. There was just so much about William Steed that I found interesting. There are four or five books about him, and I researched all those books and tried to condense it into, you know, my book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you did a great job. It is a fascinating read. So, again, check out White Crow Books and put in the name Michael Time, and that's T like Tom, Y, M like Mary, N like Nellie. Michael, thanks so much. It was great having a chance to chat with you. Fascinating material. Have a great afternoon in that wonderful area where the sun shines more than it rains.
Yeah, thank you very much, Donna. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Michael. Bye-bye. Aloha. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. When we come back, well, telephone lines will be open, and I'll have other good things to share with you as well. But let's take a break. We'll be back in just a bit.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Phone lines are now open. Give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. I want to take this opportunity to thank the wonderful people at Bridgeport Place. The class we held on Saturday was absolutely wonderful. I so appreciate the people that came out, and we will be letting you know when the next one comes up. But it was so much fun to be able to interact with those that attended, the students, and show how the power of the mind is with all of us, and the accuracy with the exercises of students doing things without any kind of apparatus at all, or actually any kind of tool. They were able to find how accurate their minds were, how good their intuitive impressions were. Meanwhile, give me a buzz at 888-627-6008, and I'll be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. I wanted to share with you a story about O'Hara Lindebach. Now, this is about a subject matter, some material that came up in the 1800s. In fact, it was about April 19th of 1820. There was a woman by the name of Ms. Mailhoff, O'Hara Linda. Now, she happened to get an old manuscript, and it had been found in an inheritance that was part of a 10-year-old nephew's, well, what do I want to say, his inheritance. It was something that he had been given when a family member died, and she saw this, and she went and she hid it. Now, you'd say to yourself, she didn't have any business doing that, which is true. Now, this is considered quite a mysterious manuscript. It was called, after her, the O'Hara Lindebach. Now, it's a mix of historical documentation and also some magical stories with it. And this book, this manuscript, I should say, had been in the family since the 6th century B.C. Now, in 1848, there was a member of the family that found it, and they took the manuscript to a Dr. Verges, who determined that it had been written on cotton paper using iron-free black ink, and had been copied in 1256 from a previous document. Now, this fascinating manuscript talks about a northern continent. Now, the continent was called Atland, not Atlantis, but Atland, A-T-L-A-N-D. They described it as a semicircular landmass off of the Netherlands, Frisian coast. And it had a wonderful environment. It was semi-tropical. It had a lot of food, and the people that were there were just very peaceful. It was a wonderful, wonderful environment. Up until 2193 BC. And at that time, something happened that created a tremendous, tremendous natural event. And it was a catastrophe, and it totally destroyed the island. Now, some of the people on the island survived, and they moved south. Now, here are some of the topics this old, old manuscript copied. It talked about the Greek hero Ulysses visiting Atland in search of a sacred lamp that would make him king of Italy. It had in it numerical symbols coming from ancient Frisian language rather than Arabic. It said that Atland's use of Britain was as a penal colony, and that Atland's legendary founder was a half-mythical woman named Freyja. There was a warrior named Frisco, who was an officer of Alexander the Great and an offspring of the Frisians who went south after the disaster to Punjab, India, about 1550 BC. Now, you can imagine coming across a manuscript like this, you'd want to publish it, wouldn't you? Well, the man that reviewed all the material wanted it published, but publishers weren't too interested. First of all, they thought it was fraudulent. But in 1876, there was a London publisher that said, you know what? I like this. This is so unique. We're going to publish it. So they not only published the translation of this, but they also had the original Frisian script printed right alongside the translation under the title of the Lara Linda Book from a manuscript of the 13th century. Now, this book comprises six books, although only one of the six is actually a book. Four are classed as writings, and one is a compilation of two letters written centuries apart. Fascinating stuff. What's even more amazing is that it survived all of that time. So history has a lot of mysteries, as we know, and it is wise of us to consider that there's a lot more we're going to find out about as time goes on, especially with all of the technology that we have developed. There are so many points of research that are coming forth today. I've got so many materials on my table, my review table, that it absolutely amazes me. And of course, it's coming forth so quickly that you're really hard-pressed to keep up with it. You wonder, how in the world can you stay up with all of this phenomenal discovery that is occurring and have clarity with all of it? Well, it is an adventure. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat today, 888-627-6008. Now, tomorrow we're going to be talking about the seven secrets of time travel with Von Breschler. And this, I think, you'll find very interesting. On Wednesday, we'll talk about what the animals taught me, Stephanie Marone, her experiences with all kinds of animals. It's just such an interesting thing to listen to. And then on Thursday, we'll be talking about women's spirituality with Mary Faulkner. And then on Friday, it's going to be a murder mystery, the Valentino formula with Michael Oldham. Lots of good things this week, so I hope you'll have the opportunity to join me, and I'm so glad you are with me today. Well, let's talk about food cravings for just a minute, and we all have them at one time or another, but according to Deanna Minnick, she said, each food has its own unique personality, from attention-getting crunchy snacks to those ooey-gooey, squishy, soft pastry that we like to indulge in every once in a while. So, someone didn't have anything else to do. They decided to do a little research on food. Well, to find out what your personality traits are. Now, if you really like crunchy stuff, if you enjoy it, well, they say you yearn to be heard. So if people are listening to you, it's suggested, write it out. The first person you should express yourself to is yourself. Write in a journal. It's an emotional dress rehearsal that'll get you in touch with your feelings, so it's easier to express them to others. Caffeine, you need that triple super-duper Starbucks in the morning or the equivalent. Or maybe you like your tea so strong that you can stand a spoon up in it. Well, apparently, if you like that caffeine fix, you like mental challenges. You love being in the middle of the intellectual action and absorbing a lot of information. So, if you want to crush this intense craving for caffeine, close your eyes. Now, what they say is caffeine gives you a false sense of sharpness and really can exhaust you after a while. You can go from a real big high to a low. But take time just to close your eyes. Maybe meditate for just a moment. Just being quiet will enable you to have an influx of new ideas. And then if you really like your sweets, well, what it is, if you have cravings for sweets, you want more fun in your life, craving sweets means you're looking for more pleasure. You're working so hard that you want something that's going to lighten up your life a little bit. And multitasking, well, that's something you do quite naturally, but it doesn't leave you with very much time for play. So why don't you give yourself some private time? Give yourself that time to play. Take a dance class. Go and do some art. Do something that for you is a lot of fun, that makes you feel good. And also, you may be having some blood sugar drops, so have little meals all during the day, and that'll keep your blood sugar high. And last but not least, spicy. She said, if you like spicy food, you like excitement in your life, and you probably love a touch of adventure. So you don't like being bored. And if you want to crush that craving, and I'd question that, then what you want to do is become more creative. Spicy foods, she said, revs your imagination. And you've got all of this creative energy, and it needs to be put in some kind of an outlet. So again, get involved in something that allows you to get out of what you consider the mundane. So that's just a little bit of fun stuff regarding food cravings, what you can do with them, and maybe you don't want to do anything with them. Maybe you just want to enjoy them. But a little bit of what they call psychological insight into what you can do if those cravings seem to be a little bit out of control. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break for a minute. When we come back, I'm going to be sharing a story with you about a young man who had a mysterious illness for 7 years, and how he managed to cope with it before they found out what it was. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be coming back in just a moment.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007, that's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic. Safe for children, too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi. Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. If you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. For those of you in New York City, I am going to be visiting that wonderful, wonderful Big Apple. I am going to be there on November 27th and 28th. So if you or a friend are interested in setting up a private appointment with me while I'm there, I would be delighted to meet with you. So you can always call me at my office, 253-582-5604. Also, I'm going to be traveling up to the far north, Alaska. I'll be up there May 1st through May the 7th. And again, if you would like to meet with me, I'll be in both Fairbanks as well as Anchorage. And at that time, starting May 1st, my show will be broadcast in the morning from 9 until 10 a.m. Pacific time. So be sure that you make that note so that you can still enjoy the programming just earlier in the day, no matter, or evening, no matter where you are. Donna Sebo here, 888-627-6008. Well, there's a young man by the name of Cliff. He's in California. He developed an illness, and he was so sick. It started off, he had a lot of high fevers. His fever would go so high, it would be like 107 degrees. Then his energy just totally went away, became totally exhausted. He had dizzy spells. He was nauseous. Now, he had been working for Disney, but he just got so ill he couldn't continue it. And life changed dramatically when you're that sick. Nobody can figure out what's going on with you. Friends go away. You end up perhaps going back to your family's home, which is what happened with him. He moved back in with his parents because he couldn't take care of himself. Everything that he had built as an identity, as an individual, was disappearing. It was just evaporating away. And this went on for a few years. But he said, I have to do something. I really got to do something. So one day, because he always felt really at his best in the morning, he decided that he was going to drive to a certain area. And it was Menlo Park. And his mom was concerned. She said, you know, I don't know that you should be driving. She responded the way any mom would. Are you sure this is what you want to do? And he said, yes, I've got to do it. Well, what really concerned her is that there was a major storm that was coming in, and she was concerned about his safety. And she said, you need to just have a little bit more faith. You need to realize that even though you're going through difficult times, there is light at the end of the tunnel. And there was a church that he had found out about, and a friend said, you know, they could sure use some volunteers at this church. Why don't you go over there and see if you can help them out? And he said, I think I would do that. Now, one of the big things that physicians had been telling him, because he had been so sick for so long, is that he had to make sure that he had rest. Because apparently this had something to do with his autoimmune system. And when he got fatigued, that's when things really, really got bad. Well, you know what? He got to this facility just in time. There was a place for him to stay. The storm hit. And he said, a change had really occurred in me. And he went to a window, and he looked out the window, and here was this tremendous landscape that he was able to see that was just covered in green grass, and the words green pastures came into his mind. And he realized that he had to have a little bit of faith, and he had to trust. And he said it took a few more years before we found out really was wrong. In fact, they found out that there was a rare drug-resistant bacteria that had invaded his body. And the reason that he got such high fevers and nausea, the body was doing the best it could to fight off this drug-resistant bacteria. So they figured out what they had to do, and they put him on a 10-day fast. The only thing that he was allowed was water, and it worked. And it took him again a few more years to regain his strength. And he said now he's got a successful career, and he thinks about the long ordeal that he went through. And he said to himself, I really feel that I had to believe in the green pastures that were ahead for me. And I had to have a lot of trust and a lot of faith. And he said, I realized throughout that whole experience, I was never alone. And he said, it really enabled me to go that extra mile until we were able to resolve what was going on with me physically. I think so many of us have challenges of different types, and we get very frustrated and very concerned because we wonder if there's ever an end to it. Well, there usually is. And sometimes, like Cliff, you have to go through a very, very long process. But the biggest thing is to remember that it's up to us to pay attention to what we put into our heads. I have a very dear friend who's going through some real severe physical challenges right now. And she made an interesting statement to me about a week ago. She said, I have just come to the awareness of how much anger and resentment I have carried inside of myself for so many years. And being in this phase of illness and going through the treatments I'm going through, she said, because I had time to be by myself, I realized that it was up to me to let go of this garbage that I've carried for so long. And I've known this person for many years, and I thought, what a profound awareness. And I think sometimes we have to be challenged before we start paying attention to what goes on in our lives. And I don't say that there's an easy fix or that there is an instantaneous miracle. It can happen. But sometimes we just have to wake up to really what goes on inside of our heads that stirs our emotions and our feelings, that can create sometimes the very thing we don't want, so that we can pay attention to what we do need to pay attention to. Donna Sebo here, quick like a bunny. I wanted to share something with you, a real easy recipe for an orange pecan salad. This is so, so easy. And if you're like me, sometimes you just want something really, really fast and quick to put together. This is what you need, a half a cup of pecans. You need about 6 tablespoons or more of the Greek-style vinaigrette salad dressing. You're going to need 2 tablespoons of chopped fresh dill, and a package, 6 to 12 ounces, whatever you prefer, of your favorite lettuce mix. And those are so easy in a grocery store. All you do is buy them. They're already cleaned and ready to go. And then a head of endive you cut crosswise into 1/2 1-inch wide slices. 1 can of mandarin oranges, you drain those, and 1/2 cup of crumbled feta cheese. And if you like, slice up a little bit of red onion, if you like onion. And all you have to do, because you want to toast your pecans, is heat up a dry skillet, toss your pecans in there, stirring them until they're lightly browned, and they smell so wonderful. That takes about 3 or 4 minutes. And then in a bowl, toss your salad dressing, your dill together, whip that a little bit with a whisk, add your lettuce mix, your endive, your oranges, feta cheese, your onion if you so desired, and your pecans, and you've got a delicious salad to serve immediately. Good stuff. This is Donna Sebo. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Have a magnificent day. Join us tomorrow to find out about the 7 secrets of time travel. Talk with you then, same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.